Hello, everybody, and welcome to an extended free preview of this month's episode of What a Cartoon Movie, all about an extremely goofy movie. I'm one of your hosts, the bundle of yesness, Bob Mackey, and who is here with me today, as always?
Shoveling cheesy nachos into his face, Henry Gilbert.
And yes, a goofy movie turns 30 years old this year, but since we already covered that, we are covering the next best thing, an extremely goofy movie, which turns 25 this year, and nobody is celebrating but us. But this podcast is kicking off our Disney Aughts Summer Series, so this is the perfect place to start when talking about the rocky ups and downs of Disney in that very strange period.
Yeah, we have a whole lot of fun talking about this extremely 2000 core end of history movie that is, I think they have a lot of fun with it, even though it is certainly slighter than a goofy movie. And we have a lot of our own personal memories of being basically the age of Max when this movie came out, too.
Yes, and on this free preview, you're going to hear a little bit of our very long history of this movie. But if you want to hear the entire thing and get access to, I think, nearly 7 years of What a Cartoon Movie episodes, head on over to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons and sign up at that $10 level. And when you do, you can access the rest of this podcast, like I said, but also that huge back catalog. We've covered so many movies over the past nearly 7 years. The entire Disney Renaissance. We've covered anime movies. We've covered weird movies like the Rocko's Modern Life movie, the Beavis and Butthead movies. We've covered Don Bluth stuff like The Secret of Nim and An American Tale. If there is an animated movie out there, we probably covered it. And if not, we'll probably cover it soon because it's all happening at that $10 level, only at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. And the $10 level, of course, includes all of the $5 stuff. Henry, what's happening there?
Well, you get, first off, a bunch of ad-free episodes. You wouldn't hear ads like this one at the start or at any point in episodes of Talking Simpsons or our monthly What a Cartoon regular podcast. But that's just the start because you get access to over 200 exclusive podcasts only for $5 and up, folks, and that is growing each month, where we cover Talking Futurama and Talking the Hill, a new episode each month of us going super in-depth into an episode of Futurama, an episode of King of the Hill. We are deep into the Comedy Central era of Futurama, and we're in season 4 of King of the Hill, which is just about to get its own new season. And when you sign up at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons, you get to see the entire back catalog of Futurama and King of the Hill podcasts we've covered for years and years. Plus, we've done podcasts about every episode of The Critic, every episode of Mission Hill, and many of our favorite episodes of Batman the Animated Series. Perfect companions to all of the awesome stuff you're going to hear when you sign up at the $10 level to hear all of the What a Cartoon movies like this one.
And if you've never signed up for Patreon before, it's so easy to do. And when you sign up, you can access all of our bonus podcasts alongside of all of our free podcasts the same way you access any of your podcasts via your favorite podcast app or program. And there is also a Patreon app for any smart device you might have. You can listen to all of our bonus content there as well. But no matter what way you do it, it's very, very easy to access all of the bonus podcasts waiting for you at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. Now that is it for this little intro. We recommend you don't try to eat gooey nachos with your white gloves while you listen to a portion of our history on an extremely goofy movie.
Right where you want me to be. You make me feel like dancing. You make me feel like dancing. You make me feel like dancing.
Well, it's also funny as well that maybe it didn't touch me the same as well, because this is where Max was ahead of me. Like, when I was a kid at, you know, almost 13 watching the first one, I was thinking about what high school could be like, and that was something interesting to me. But this one of, like, he's a year ahead of me, like, oh, I'll go off to college soon too, won't I? And maybe that, like, scared me more, or I also couldn't see myself as, like, I wouldn't be like Max or PJ and what their college plans are in this movie.
Yeah, I was going to talk about this later, but it does perfectly line up with the Goof Troop chronology. They follow, like, a real time calendar in which Max, he's 11 and Goof Troop are 10, and then he's presumably late middle school, early high school in a goofy movie, and now in the year 2000, this movie comes out. He's ready for college. I am too. That's when I graduated high school. I waited a semester. I enrolled in early 2001, but our lives were mirroring each other. I was a cool skateboarder.
Yes, I would go to college the next year. I graduate in May 2001, and then start August 31st, 2001, and then like 2 weeks into my college career. But mine was different, though. I didn't leave. I stayed at home and went to a community college, and then had problems. Talk about depression. I also had a lot of depression and had trouble finishing anything at it. And I went through a whole thing, too, though. I can't remember as many of the... Oh, I can remember the music I listened to a lot, and they were depressing songs. But like,
wait, you said 2 weeks. Was it 2 weeks of community college?
It was... I had 2 weeks... Sorry. It was 2 weeks of community college until September 11th is what I meant to say.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, I thought you were in school longer than that.
Oh, yeah. No, I did 2 years of community college until 1 year successfully, and the second year... As depression set in and I was having to do, I was actually following more of the PJ and Pete thing where Pete in my life was yelling at me that the school I went to wasn't good enough and I needed to go the one he wanted me to go to. And that made me feel incredibly depressed and sad. So,
well, he does seem very Pete-like.
Yes. Yeah. Honestly, watching this movie, I was like, boy, I wish my dad was more like Pete in the way that he's like, go away and get away from me. Like, I consider myself a babysitter.
Well, yes, we talked about our history with this movie. Now let's talk about the history of the movie. So I wanted to note up top that this history segment is likely going to be very light because there is no documented history of the film until now, because we are doing the first one, really. No one has bothered to write, like, here's the history of the movie. Here's the interviews with the directors. Here's, you know, just how this movie came into being. That does not exist online. So what we're doing now is the closest anyone has ever come to doing that.
Man, and it just passed its 25th anniversary. So you would think, I mean, obviously, we're going through a month of every website closing and no place employs anybody anymore. But, you know, for the 25th anniversary, you would think some enterprising writer out there would have done an oral history, you know, and pitched it.
Yeah, unfortunately, maybe 10 years ago, they would have done this. But now you're right. There are no websites left.
Yeah,
maybe someone could have wrote this for Polygon or something like that. Who knows? But yeah, so we're doing this now. It's unfolding in front of you. And I'm doing the best job I can with what little sources there are. So I guess the question is, why is this movie so undocumented? Well, a goofy movie was barely a cult hit in the year 2000, and Disney seemed kind of ashamed of it in general. But, you know, when all the middle-aged fans would grow up and have money, they're like, we love a goofy movie. It's part of the family, but not an official feature. Forget about that. But still, give us your money. Here's some merch. Here are events.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I can mention going to... I put it on a talk to the audience recently, but yeah, in April... For the 30th anniversary, this wasn't the reason we went to Los Angeles, but it just lined up with our trip. When my husband and I were there in April, they were doing the 30th anniversary screening of A Goofy Movie at the El Capitan Theater, which Disney owns. And Don Hahn, producer extraordinaire, who is so many great interviews with him have helped fuel our histories on this podcast. And I got to tell him that to his face. But he had kind of a side-eyed little joke about, like, here's how little we were released. Here's how the no merch we had then. And then he had like a slideshow of all the merch they have now that it seemed like it was a little wink of like, oh, they like merchandising this movie now, 30 years later, huh?
Yeah, they seemed ashamed of the movie. Barely a release. Most people probably think of it as a direct-to-video movie. But I honestly think maybe before we die, it'll happen. Who knows? But I want it to be grandfathered in as an official feature. If much worse things can be part of the official lineage of the Disney feature animation brand, I feel like this should be included in retrospect.
Yeah, it was so funny on the stage, too, that Don Hahn was talking with Kevin Lima about it and its station in the Disney in Disney in 1994 to 95. Production and how he was like scraping by money and trying to get like time and budget and everything. And Don Hahn talks about how like he was mainly working on Lion King then. And he was like, yeah, we saw this as a B picture when we worked on Lion King. Like, who's going to care about a little cat that's Hamlet? Who's going to give a crap? But then that means you guys were like on a G level film that we're, if we're B, you're G.
It was just a long wait for Pocahontas and Toy Story, I guess, internally. They're like, these are the ones we're rolling the dice on.
They thought Pocahontas, like you said on that and that great one we did last year, that they thought that was going to be their best picture winner. Like, Pocahontas was like the one. It was going to be their greatest one.
Well, I will say that I have reached out to the director of an extremely goofy movie, Douglas McCarthy. He seems like he was fairly online. So I hate to point this out because he has not responded to me. But if he does respond, I will include the question and answers in the second part of the podcast. But he has not updated his website in years, so who knows? And maybe he is kind of done with that part of his life. But I just want to say, I'm only doing this so I can show you my work. I did reach out to the director.
Bob and, is trying.
There are no interviews about this movie at all with anyone, and I was trying to do the first one.
This is the downside also of like social media and everything falling apart. Like you can't, 10 years ago, you could more easily like just at reply or send messages to these people and reach out to them. Now as social media becomes like an AI sludge filled pile of garbage, like it's like the connections are going away and it sucks.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I didn't look on Twitter or Blue Sky. I went to his website, which we'll talk about later. And there's an email address. It's one of those things where I'm thinking you're in your 60s. I don't know if you check this. I don't know how invested you are in talking to me about this. But if he does get back to me at some point, it'll be in this podcast or maybe we'll cover it later on like Talk to the Audience if it's a later reply. But I do want to have the first interview about this movie if I can get it.
That is old school. Just an email on a website. Man, that feels like the year 2000. Like
I literally clicked on a contact section of a blog spot.
Wow. Well, I'm crossing my fingers then that you'll hear back soon.
So I want to beef up this movie history segment by talking about the original Goofy movie, which, like you said, Henry, recently celebrated its 30th birthday. And so this movie released in theaters on April 7th, 1995, didn't make much of a splash, though it did take in double its $18 million budget. I don't think it was in theaters for very long. I think they pulled it pretty early and just decided this will be a video project now because Return of Jafar made so much. We were not anticipating that market, but now it's there. Let's pull it from theaters and shove it onto video.
Oh, yeah. It definitely was seen as a thing from a previous administration, a Jeffrey Katzenberg project that comes out after Katzenberg has been fired by the company. And so it also is not going to get that kind of support in a post-Katzenberg Disney company.
And it was technically a Disney Toon Studios production, which is why it's not part of the official lineage of their feature animated works. And if you want to hear about Disney Toon, go back to our podcast about DuckTales, the movie Treasure of the Lost Lamp. We talk about it there. That movie is bad, by the way.
Yes.
We go over that in great detail on that podcast.
Yeah, you know, it's funny in the, sorry if I'm getting ahead of it, that new documentary and not just a goof. When they talk about DuckTales, they very lightly talk about it, but they don't want to be too mean, but they are like, that was a mistake, or this let people down. We were trying to not do the things that movie did, is the nicest things they say about it.
So in the late 90s, a Goofy movie, not popular, not considered a success. There are people who like it, like us, but we are in the minority, or we're not worth their time quite yet. Again, wait till we're middle-aged and have money to spend. Yeah. Then we'll talk. So a sequel does not seem likely to a Goofy movie. And in any case, Disney rarely sequelized their features at this point in time. In fact, I think The Rescuers Down Under was their only animated sequel in theaters for most of their history until very, very recently when they're all about sequels now.
Yeah. Quite a difference even 25 years makes. But yeah, when we cover that one as well, isn't that what a cartoon? The production began before the Renaissance began. And then by the time it comes out after A Little Mermaid, it's like, oh, this isn't where the things are going. They also pull the plug on that very quickly as well. Just like I probably even faster than a Goofy movie.
So The Return of Jafar, which we podcasted about, just a reminder, huge hit on video. This opened the door for an entirely new market for original animated films. So Tiny Toon Adventures, How I Spent My Vacation, we also covered that. That was really the pioneer, but Return of Jafar was the big mega hit that really signaled everybody, this is the new gravy train, hop on board. But unfortunately, enthusiasm for these releases quickly faded. People began to see them as what they were, cheap, cynical cash-ins that didn't even approach the level of theatrical animation. But check out Lion King 2, which we covered. That is what brought people back. They attempted to make it on nearly the level of theatrical animation, and they nearly succeeded. I feel like it is so close, it's barely discernible. Like, what is feature? What is direct-to-video? But that was a one-off, unique project. They did not really do that again until much, much later.
That one closed the gap as much as anything. And yeah, it definitely seemed its budget was probably comparable to the competition's theatrically released ones on Lion King 2. And yeah, like they got away with something with Return of Jafar, that Return of Jafar just was a three-part TV special, basically, that they then put on a tape and sold millions of them. And same with the third Aladdin movie, I'm sure we'll do someday. Like, at least on that one, it felt like they were saying, we spend the money to get Robin Williams back. This is not just the cheap TV show with a TV voice guy. Robin Williams is back.
Right. Every once in a while, they would say, see, this one's not crap. And then they would make eight more that were crap.
Yes. Yeah.
Although on the animation side of things, we'll talk about that too. Usually, mostly if Walt Disney Japan or Australia were in charge, you would get some very good animation. And I think that is the best feature of all of these. Now that they're just all on Disney Plus, you don't need to spend $20 to see them. It is fun just to see some of the best work by Walt Disney Japan, Walt Disney Australia, and so on. The stories are usually bad. The music is usually not great, but it is a showcase for some of the best animation quality on that level.
Yeah, and this movie has several moments of great character animation that I'm like, wow, this is punching above its weight of what I imagined it to be. But yeah, you're right. You can feel like the direct-to-video Disney stuff is trying to prove it's better than the expectation.
So if you want to know where Disney's DTV material was at the time, the answer is the toilet, quality-wise, because this movie comes hot on the heels of Belle's Tales of Friendship,
ooh,
which was the last direct-to-video Beauty and the Beast movie, which I think it feels like a bunch of episodes. I didn't look too much into that. We also have Winnie the Pooh, Seasons of Giving, and then Mickey's Once Upon a Christmas, which notably has the segment A Very Goofy Christmas, which seems to take place in the Goof Troop universe because it features Max, although he is a kid in that segment. So they are kind of priming the pump for more goofy stuff in the same year, actually, or like actually right before the year 2000 with the Once Upon a Christmas direct-to-video release.
I totally forgot about that as one of the Max and Goofy scenes in it. Yeah, no, the Belle one is 100%. They were making a Beauty and the Beast series, and then they canceled it after like producing a few episodes. And that's why I believe it is a framing device of Belle reflecting on stories with the other candles and whatever.
That sounds right.
Candles.
That sounds right.
Yeah.
Yeah, not great. Everyone knew what this was. They're like, my kid wants this. There's no YouTube channel for them to look at all day, so I have to buy this.
And I think after this one releases, like, they were going to do an Atlantis TV show and a Tarzan TV show. Or I know on Tarzan, they were going to do a second season of their TV show, and they're like, cancel it, forget it. And then that became a movie, Tarzan and Jane, similarly.
Yeah, with Atlantis, it was they were getting a TV series off the ground. The movie did not succeed, so they scrapped the series and salvaged three episodes to stitch together. Well, what would have been the pilot for the series, like the multi-part pilot, ended up being a sequel movie.
And I don't know if anything like this came up in your research, but watching this movie, I felt like it could have been the opposite. This could be the pilot of a Goofy and Max in college series.
In fact, I mean, we'll get to it, but the ending seems to imply that it is setting up a series before Goofy's like, just kidding, and then he drives away.
Yeah, it's like, flush, nah, this isn't a they weren't as IP-driven back then. It seems like missing an opportunity that Disney would never let them not do now.
Yeah, absolutely. This should have been a 65-episode Disney Channel show afterwards to get the most out of this. So that is the history of Disney's DTV content leading up to an extremely goofy movie. And when I say there was no fanfare behind this movie, I mean there was no fanfare. I can't find any article announcing the release of the film, although I'm sure there was a press release from Disney saying, here's our upcoming slate of direct-to-video movies. I'm sure that's all it got. And like a lot of these movies, this was regarded as disposable junk designed to be forgotten. So kind of like the late 90s equivalent of a modern direct-to-streaming movie where you watch it, it fills up a night, but you quickly forget it exists and it's out of your brain and life forever.
In my case, you walk by it on the shelf at Hollywood Video and you go like, okay. And then you move on with your life to more anime that you haven't seen yet. That you're so impressed has both subs and dubs on the same disc.
How do they do that? We'll never know. Well, because very little of this movie is documented, I'll be mining every possible element for some sort of history just to pad out this history segment. So the roots of an extremely goofy movie date back to 1996. So that is 1 year after a goofy movie. And this is when the Walt Disney Company acquired a little broadcasting network, ABC, in one of their essential properties, the Entertainment and Sports Programming Network, or ESPN, because yes, this movie features the sweetest plum, integrated marketing. That's the reason why this is about the X Games and why ESPN branding is all over this movie. In a way, it's kind of a commercial for ESPN and the X Games.
It's to the extreme media integration. Yeah, it is a huge turning point in for the worse in children's entertainment and all entertainment. How Kids WB, Disney's One Saturday Morning, like these things all change how animation gets done in the 90s for the worse, I would say. But yeah, that all of the ESPN stuff in here is very funny to watch. And you know what? I feel like used pretty all right.
Except it does imply that ESPN runs a shoddy ship and
yeah.
They create giant X's that will trap players inside of them when they catch on fire.
Also, like, there must be rampant cheating at all of these X Games because they're pretty obvious who's cheating and how to follow it if anybody with half a brain is watching these things.
Yeah, they're being implicated with this movie. I don't think they knew that. So yeah, the X Games begin in 1995 as a sort of cool version of the Olympics for skater dudes. And they were gaining a lot of momentum up through the late 90s, as were all extreme sports. Like you said, Henry, this is the era of Tony Hawk's Pro Skater. Like, everybody got their own extreme sports game. I feel like this was petering out by the early to mid-aughts, but that kind of phenomenon, that kind of culture was very, very strong up through, like, shortly after 9/11.
I do feel in my personal memory of having a brother who did like checklist cataloging of doing everything you possibly can in Tony Hawk 1, 2, and 3. It did feel like it crested with 3, that was with the launch of the GameCube in my memory. Like, it was a GameCube launch game we purchased was Tony Hawk Pro Skater 3. And after that, after 9/11, I think, though, too, it got poisoned, but for an expansion of it, they're like, well, Jackass is like friends with Tony Hawk. So they basically just become half Jackass games until the point they get taken over. And it's like, it just became potty humor, the series. There was that was also a tipping point for him.
Yeah, because I guess Jackass, did that start as like skate videos, or am I thinking of the
other
one?
No. It definitely a short version of it. I was just thinking about this, too, because you and your wife, Nina, you logged her. And I was thinking, like, yeah, that Nina mentioned in her review, Spike Jonze hasn't done a narrative theatrically released film since that. And I was looking at it like many of his recent credits are Jackass. Like, he is in the Jackass. He is a forming member of Jackass and a filmer of it, because a bunch of skateboarders who are young and feel indestructible when they have time in between filming stuff with their video cameras are like, hey, what if you punch me in the balls? And that turns into video content. Like, oh, could you shit your pants if you tried? I've got a camera here. Let's figure out. So it's a natural extension of early skate videos. Yes.
Yeah. Jackass just came out of the sketches that were in skate videos. And actually, I don't think I'd ever watched a skate video. I was not part of that culture until we went to a bar, I don't know, 6 months ago. And they just had one of these 90s skate videos on. And I was like, wow, this is what this was. And it's exactly what you're describing. Skate tricks, people like falling off their skateboards, injuring themselves, and also like sketches with super inside references that I don't understand.
Yes. That was some of my favorite stuff in early Tony Hawk was, one, it basically functioned as a mixtape, so you could learn about cool punk and pop punk bands and some hip hop as well. I could have used a little more hip hop, but then when you would, you know, complete a run with one skater, you'd then get a real life skate video of their tricks. And it would just be like a set to a song. You'd get like a 2 minute skate video in there. And yes, then eventually Jackass gets on TV. Me and my pals like Jackass. I know it's crazy because I don't like scatological stuff in so many places, and yet my brain has a Jackass exception.
Still can't believe it.
Yes, and then you want to hit a harder thing, so you go to CKY videos, Camp Kill Yourself, which get even filthier and disgusting.
Oh, that's what that stands for.
Yes. Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Yes, that's it's fair. It's, hey, it was the 90s, man. It's how it goes.
You know what? I'm looking at Jackass now. This is all related, by the way. We're filling up time here. But the pilot aired about 2 weeks after this movie releases. So the pilot airs in April of 2000. The series proper starts in October of 2000. It runs for 24 episodes.
Wow. Yeah, no, it was huge for my friends and me in a bad way. It made everybody else think, could I get a camera and hurt myself? And a lot of people did, despite what it said on the front of it. I think of that now. Now, I said this on another one recently, but back then, they at least tried to tell you, if you film yourself doing jackass shit, we're not going to put it on TV. Don't imitate this. Now, every TikTok is like, it's the contest of imitate doing a jackass thing and yours can get popular.
Yes, it's the blank challenge. And then you have to do it yourself and get whatever online cred you get from that. Does TikTok pay you? I forget how that works.
I don't think so. I think it's up to you to get your own marketing deals on TikTok if it gets popular enough, I think.
I see. Okay, well, we don't know how the movie came into being, but if we speculate, I think we can just say it feels correct that a goofy movie was laser targeted towards youth culture of 95. This is laser targeted towards youth culture of the year 2000. And they are zeroing in on, oh, the extreme sports thing and what can go along with that. Max going to college. Okay, all of these things are lining up. It feels like a natural fit. And then we can kind of rip off Back to School with Goofy going to college. Back to School being the Rodney Dangerfield movie where he goes back to school in a very hilarious circumstances will ensue from there.
With a perfect title song. I love that song. The baby taking you back to school.
You know what? I've never seen it.
You know, I've only watched it once on Comedy Central, but I've listened to that theme song a million times.
That seems like the ideal back to school viewing experience.
Yeah, it's also, well, you'll never believe how young Robert Downey Jr. can be until you see that. But yeah, I think it's fair for them to rip off Back to School or in other college films in a G-rated way when Kevin Lima was very clear in pretty much any interview when he approached a Goofy movie. He's like, I want to make a John Hughes high school film, but with Disney characters and Goofy in it. And so that one was John Hughes. Now it's like, well, what were the 80s college films? This is, you know, the getting rid of all the sex romps or lightening them up as much as possible in this movie.
Although they keep the drugs because Goofy does drop acid before taking a test in this movie.
Somebody doses him, yes. For sure. Yeah.
Put it under my tongue. Okay.
Gorsh.
Yeah. It is following a very simple formula. But I like this movie. I gave it a 2.5 out of 5 on Letterboxd. I like some of the swerves it takes, though, because it does, unfortunately, have to follow a lot of the same beats as the original movie. But the one element I do like is Goofy goes to college. He is not an embarrassment to Max, although Max is embarrassed of him. Everybody likes him and thinks he's cool. And I like that as an interesting twist on this very stock premise.
And I also like that, like, Max doesn't have to relearn lessons he learned in the first movie. Like, he's not the same kid he was before. He's grown up. He's not as mean to Goofy in the ways he was in the first movie. Like, you can tell he's grown and changed, but he's the same type of guy. And I had forgotten the emotionality of some scenes in the movie. I think they didn't forget the emotion of a Goofy movie. They don't do it as much, but Goofy walking through his house, his empty nest, like that is, they just take time to be sad in that bit.
Yeah. I think maybe they might dwell on it a little too much, though. We'll talk about it. But I was watching it with Nina and she's like, why is Goofy so sad all the time? A lot of the movie is dwelling on Goofy being depressed.
Yeah. Well, I wish they could say, unspoken in the movie is Goofy is a widower and lonely. Yeah. He can't say my dead wife, gosh. Like they can't say that. But, you know, it makes sense to get to the extreme thing, though, too, that for Max's character, he was a Bart Simpson skateboard kid in Goof Troop, then got into Powerline and made that his whole character, his persona in early high school. And now he, as Tony Hawk got more popular, he comes back to the extreme sports he loved as a Bart Simpson copycat kid.
Yeah, that is true. I will say Max is kind of boring in this movie. I don't really get a sense of like who he is or what he wants to do. I like to know, like, why are you going to college? Not just for the X Games.
Well, he's supposed to, you know, you don't get a sense of what his major is, that's for sure. But
well, actually, I might repeat myself later, but that is really the end of history sense about what college is. You go there and then when you're done, you get a job. That's what I told my wife when Goofy gets his diploma at the end. She's like, well, what is his diploma in? It's like, it doesn't matter. He finished college. He can bring that anywhere, like all of our parents told us.
And you can visit, you know, the social infrastructure of unemployment services to get you would find a job for you. Like, you can count on the government to do that for you in the year 2000.
So yeah, that is really all the material I could put together. So now we could talk about the people behind the movie. And this movie is directed by Douglas McCarthy. So in terms of directing, he has his roots in Warner Brothers and not Disney. So before this, he directed a lot of Tasmania, a show we still need to cover, as well as the modern, meaning 30 years ago, Warner Brothers shorts, Carrot Blanca and Marvin the Martian in the Third Dimension. So these two shorts weren't really seen by a lot of people because Carrot Blanca was placed before The Amazing Panda Adventure. And this Marvin the Martian short could only be seen at an Australian theme park, a German theme park, and the Warner Brothers Studio Store in New York City. Although I believe it was placed on a DVD later as an extra.
That makes sense that Warner would like spend all that money and then not bother to put it out. I forget which one it was. It wasn't Carrot Blanca because I would have killed to see Carrot Blanca. Like, I didn't see a NeverEnding Story 1 until after I saw a NeverEnding Story 2 because I believe it had a Looney Tunes short before it. And that's why I begged my mom to take me to see NeverEnding Story 2 before I'd even seen the first NeverEnding Story.
Well, I'm looking at the box office on The Amazing Panda Adventure. Nobody saw it because it made $7.5 million.
Wow, that's like a third of a Goofy movie or a fourth of it. Like, that's terrible.
And I think I remember hearing from Thad, our friend of the show, that Carrot Blanca was a very expensive short and it looks great, but they never did anything like that again.
Yeah, you can see the... It's been a long time since I've seen Carrot Blanca, but it definitely looks like it had a way bigger budget than like the Chuck Jones ones that came out just even a little bit afterwards in the 90s.
Yeah, and that Marvin the Martian short I mentioned is sort of like a 3D movie ride short where you're just experiencing like different effects. You're wearing 3D glasses as you're watching it, and it's on YouTube if you want to see it. It's essentially... they're trying to do Looney Tunes with early CGI, and they're kind of getting it right, although you can see the limitations holding them back. It's just interesting to see this was an experiment that around the age of Toy Story 1. Just like, can we do this? Can we do Squash and Stretch with CGI? And they kind of get it right.
Wow, so that's interesting, though. This guy's background you're telling me about here first is, you know, Warner Productions, that he was like this Warner TV guy, and then... limited Warner feature shorts to then at some point move over to Disney.
Yeah, he has a very extensive career. We can only go over a little bit of it here, but he directs this movie and then he directs an episode of something here, an episode of something there. Although it seems like he doesn't really do a lot of directing. The most prominent directing role after this, he was a series director on a portion of the mid-aughts Tom and Jerry series, Tom and Jerry Tales, which I have never seen. There's a lot of Tom and Jerry modern stuff, and I'm sure it's all very mid.
I can never wrap my head around how there are, I think, like a dozen direct-to-video Tom and Jerry movies, like almost as many as like the Scooby-Doo characters have gotten in the past 20 years, including like Tom and Jerry got their own Roger Rabbit-y type Looney Tunes in the real world movie that was a direct-to-max film in the pandemic.
Oh, right. It had Colin Jost. Is it Yost? Is it Jost?
I believe it's Jost, yeah.
Okay.
No matter how you say his name, he looks like the most smug person who's ever lived.
That's true, yeah. And I like all those Tom and Jerry direct-to-DVD things, I just see them memed online by Zoomers.
Yeah, though occasionally I would see the direct-to-video animated ones because you would see like somebody would just pull out like 90 seconds of it like, what is this fluid animation, this, you know, Tom and Jerry on the Wizard of Oz or whatever it's called? And there's like 90 seconds of incredible animation in there.
Yeah, there are always crossovers with existing Warner Brothers properties.
Yeah, Wizard of Oz and definitely the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. I think they did a Willy Wonka one as well, for sure. I remember seeing that.
And they didn't ever do a movie version of this, but when I was in Japan, there was official merch of Tom and Jerry as Batman characters because Japan loves Tom and Jerry.
Oh, yeah. When I was just there in February, Tom and Jerry was a coffee chain that isn't Starbucks had a tie-in Tom and Jerry thing.
Tully's?
I think it was Tully's. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So in terms of his career as a whole, Douglas McCarthy began as a storyboard artist and character designer on The Littles way back in 1985. Now, I've never seen this. I have seen The Little Bits, but that is not helpful at all.
Oh, wait. Yeah. Sorry. I was thinking of The Little Bits, too. Like, is The Littles are also The Borrowers? Is that it, too?
I think they're borrower adjacents. I never saw this movie. I think people have good memories of it, and I think it is kind of anime. But, yeah, it's actually a series of novels, so it's not The Borrowers. But
Okay.
I think there's a lawsuit at hand. They're very similar.
It's so weird. There were, yeah, I feel like as a kid, I saw like 8 different things that were like The Borrowers. And when I saw the Arrietty film from the Studio Ghibli film, even with that one, I was like, wait a minute, this is also like a Borrowers? Is everything? Okay, I do know the littles only because the opening, it is a TMS production, and the openings are extremely TMS, including one of the guys in the goofball character of it is just Lupin wearing like a mask of this guy's characters. He's animated just like Lupin.
Okay, well, Douglas McCarthy sent drawings to Japan, which they ignored. That's it. That was his role on this show. And yeah, Arrietty is just a Borrower's adaptation. It is literally a licensed work, I guess.
Man, I had no clue Japan loves The Borrowers that much and Borrowers type things.
So yes, he has about 80 other credits, so honestly, a lot to go over here. And though he doesn't do a lot of directing, he's kept himself very busy up through 2022, which is, that's where his last credit is. He seems especially drawn to Warner Brothers stuff, though. So if there's some kind of reinterpretation of classic Looney Tunes, he's usually on the project, like the Duck Dodgers show or the Looney Tunes show. And he also did a lot of work for Tiny Toons and the Tiny Toons movie. So he seems to love working on goofy, gag-driven Warner Brothers stuff. And if you go to his website, a lot of his art seems very Warner Brothers inspired.
Man, he probably went to all of the same parties as Eric Goldberg and Bruce Timm and all that in Burbank back in the late 80s and early 90s. That I mentioned Eric Goldberg because he has a very similar thing, too, of being like a Warner fanatic who then gets his paycheck from Disney. Goldberg loves to animate Goofy. Like, that's a lot of his projects have been Goofy projects. So it does seem like if you're a Warner guy, you can, a Looney Tunes fan, Goofy is the guy to go to for you in the Disney pantheon.
So that is Douglas McCarthy. Hopefully I can hear back from him at some point and we can report back. But moving on, the director of animation is Ian Harrowell. So I don't want to go too in-depth on him, but I wanted to point out that he was a big wheel at Walt Disney Animation Australia, which was founded in 1988, closed in 2006. But he's credited with important roles on anything that came out of this studio. So if you want an example of their work outside of this movie, check out our episodes that we put together on Bonkers and Goof Troop, because those are both Walt Disney Australia episodes, and they have basically feature-quality animation on a TV budget. They are astounding looking, even if you don't like the writing, even if you don't like Bonkers. Walt Disney Australia did a ton of great looking Bonkers. Just mute it and watch the animation. That part is excellent.
I was wondering how much Disney Australia was involved in this, because totally, like, there are some goopy things, like that when like the potato salad or whatever goops off of something, or like cheese is all goopy. I'm like, boy, that feels very Aussie to me. Like, that feels like the Walt Disney Aussie touch. And same with goofy face acting, or some Pete, when Pete talks early in the movie, I'm like, boy, that looks like a face chart from Disney Australia.
Yeah, certain characters like Bradley especially, and the big broad newscaster at the end, he is very Disney Australia. If you see how he moves, that is really how they love animating characters.
And Tank 2 feels very Disney Australia character. Yeah, but you're right, that ESPN host, his movements now, he seemingly has like no legs, or like if you saw his legs, they'd be like a foot long, and then the rest of his body's like 5 feet of torso. That also is the Australia design sense, the Disney Australia design sense.
Yeah, and I believe they did all of the movie, if not most of it, or other way around, most if not all. I mean, the credit is just animation by Walt Disney Television Animation, which tells me nothing. Usually they are more specific, but Wikipedia says Walt Disney Singapore did some stuff, and I can't even find out if that studio ever existed. So I'm not sure if that was just someone speculating, but this does seem to be primarily based on the director of animation, based on what I'm seeing on the screen, a Walt Disney Australia production.
I would bet having smaller support studios like that, though I've never heard of that Singapore one either before in my memory, but I could see them having some support studios in that same region. But yeah, I mean, I'm always on a lookout for parts of the film that would feel like Japan, Walt Disney Japan. But at that time, I think they were more on the poo side of things, I feel like.
They were knee deep in poo.
Yes.
Winnie, that is. Let's move on to other credits. So a screenplay is by a guy named Scott Gordon. So he had a 20-year career. I would not say it's an especially prestigious one. So Outside of this and the A Very Goofy Christmas segment from that direct-to-video project I talked about earlier, he never worked on another Disney thing again. And I think he was hired because in the 90s, he really specialized in youth-oriented programming about older teenagers. So he was a producer on the last season of Saved by the Bell. He was a producer on Saved by the Bell, The New Class. He transitioned to that. And then he moved to work on To City Guys, a show he co-created with the Saved by the Bell creator, Peter Engel. That was yet another Saturday morning teen show that was inspired by Saved by the Bell. So this was his market. I'm going to write like about fun, sexy teens, but children will be watching these shows. So not too spicy.
No drinking, no premarital sex, like none of just the, yeah, wow. It now this really feels like Saved by the Bell, the college years, like plot line, honestly, like this.
Yeah. It's I mean, nobody liked that show, but this really is on that level where it's about people in their late teens, early 20s, but it's designed for 8-year-olds.
Yeah. So nobody has sex. Nobody does drugs. Nobody even drinks alcohol, like. But somebody can, like, think a girl is cute, and they'll, like, dance and stuff. But
no further.
That's though Goofy 100% has sex in this movie. Like, yeah. Totally does. Yeah.
Yes, she let him hit it because he's Goofy.
Yeah.
So prior to this, he has a ton of experience doing what looks like freelance writing for a lot of popular 80s and 90s sitcoms I wasted my life watching, like Alf, Amen, The Golden Girls, A Different World, Full House, Perfect Strangers, Step by Step, and more. Everything. Again, I wasted my childhood and young adult years watching these things in reruns ad nauseum.
It's an interesting transition over to animation. You see that with a few people, but he gets to be on feature level for this, not just regular Disney TV.
And it looks like he was kind of done after this because he did this, and then he wrote a few episodes of Totally Spies, and that's the end of his IMDb. So I don't know if he retired. I don't know if he transitioned to more of like a non-creative producing role or whatever, but that is it for Scott Gordon, the writer of this film.
I could see that the French who worked on Totally Spies could have just hired him for like a freelance position for a little bit. And then after that, he's like, I'm good.
So that is Scott Gordon. And the score is by Steve Bartek. So we don't get original songs, which is becoming the style at the time. I say boo to that. This movie needs some songs. But we can at least talk about who did the score. So Steve Bartek. He's the guy from Oingo Boingo who became a film composer. No, not Danny Elfman. He's the other guy who became a film composer.
That's the man. How many meetings has he had where people go like, man, you and Danny are great together. What do you think of Danny? Like him? That's so funny. Like it's the other guy in Oingo Boingo. Wow.
So he has a ton of credits, mostly as an orchestrator, but he has done a lot of composing. He has composed scores for the following movies, things like Cabin Boy, Romy and Michelle's High School Reunion, Meet the Deedles, and Snow Day, and many other things I won't mention here. But notably, one of his earliest credits is that he was the orchestrator for the 1986 film Back to School. So his career had come full circle, I would say, 14 years later.
That is incredible. They hired the Back to School composer for their Back to School ripoff.
Well, he's the orchestrator, so they didn't go that close. Sorry. But someone composed it, he orchestrated it.
Hey, that's still impressive. Man, I agree with you that something that makes this lesser to a Goofy movie is that a Goofy movie is a musical with like multiple original songs. So they even cut some songs and like everybody loves Powerline. Love for Powerline and his songs is like at least 25% of what people love about those movies. And when you lose it, that hurts it. I did, from a musical standpoint, I did appreciate that they did spend the money on licensing real songs and having them, even if they were like some were Radio Disney cover type deals, but they got real songs from the 70s and 80s.
Yes, although I will say that this movie is kind of laser focused on making fun of the 70s because Goofy is now a product of the 70s based on the lore of this movie. Half the songs are from the 60s and the 80s that they use. Yeah, I think actually more than half. When I kept thinking during the movie, I'm like, wait, that's from the 60s. Wait, my future's so bright, I gotta wear shades. That's from the 80s. It's like from the late 80s.
Yeah, you know, maybe they did like temp tracks with Bee Gees stuff and then were told how expensive Bee Gees songs were. And they're like, how about something from the 60s? It sounds like the 70s.
Yeah, I guess the Bigfoot in A Goofy Movie did dance to the Bee Gees, right? Staying Alive.
That's true. That you're right. I had forgotten that as a bit of 70s stuff. So you know what? And that, let's say that that Walkman was Goofy's music. So it, that grows out of a characteristic in that movie, because I definitely don't think that Walkman is playing music Max listens to. No.
And weirdly enough, the Bigfoot's illegitimate son is going to college in this movie. Very strange.
That is freakish. Like, that implies that the Bigfoot in the movie is just like a nudist who is very hairy and it freaks out on everybody.